Hello, this is Chris with the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, May 5th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page, Ready to Bear Fruit. Raider Farms adds apple orchard from Normal. Visitors to Raider Family Farms this fall will find another avenue to enjoy fruits of the season with the launch of a new apple orchard. The 5-acre addition will host over 3,000 trees with 15 different varieties of apple, according to the business. It will be managed by Adam Rader, operations director for the fourth generation family farm in Normal. Apple picking is expected to be available to visitors starting in September. Adding an orchard strengthens our connection to the land and gives families another way to experience agriculture firsthand. It's about stewardship, both of the environment and the traditions that keep our farm family focused and faith-driven. He said beehives have been strategically placed throughout the farm to aid in pollination, necessary for the trees to bear fruit. The orchard adds to an array of seasonal activities already available at the 80-acre farm, a popular spot for pumpkin picking and field trips in the fall. Its wide array of activities includes a giant slide, corn maze, and everything from tetherball to tram riding. Plans are underway to expand the orchard in coming seasons, the business said. Updates on opening dates, apple availability, and special events are to be posted online and on the farm's social media accounts. Also from Normal, Vote may keep short-term rental permit freeze. The Normal Town Council will consider extending the moratorium on new short-term rental businesses by 1 month and will make further clarifications to the town's zoning code. The council today will vote on the extension, which would allow the town to respond to any new land use laws pending at the state legislature. The proposed ordinance would extend the date to July 1st. In November, the town imposed a 6-month moratorium on issuing business licenses for residential short-term rental businesses such as Airbnb owners. The moratorium is set to expire June 1st and was supposed to give the town time to consider and review regulatory alternatives for these businesses. The ordinance also requires each owner or operator of a short-term rental to obtain a general business license for each dwelling unit used as a rental space. The town does not impose a fee for these general business licenses, but it puts the owners on record and requires them to pay associated taxes. During their spring session, Illinois legislators are considering various land use bills that, if enacted, could affect the town's regulation of short-term rentals, according to town documents. The legislature is scheduled to adjourn May 31st, and extending the moratorium for a month will allow the town to review and react to any new state laws. There are 143 short-term rentals across the Twin Cities, with 63 recorded in Normal and 80 in Bloomington. There is currently no limit on how many short-term rentals can operate in Normal. In other business, the town council will consider further clarifications, address omissions, and make a few changes to the zoning code changes that were adopted October 22nd. The updates enhanced clarity, modernized terminology, and brought the code into better alignment with interpretations, variances, and the director of current policy. According to these documents, it was anticipated at the time that staff would return to the council with additional amendments within 6 months to address any errors or omissions to further clarify and to make minor amendments that may have come up since then. The proposed amendment includes corrections and clarifications to traditional yard and height requirements, fences, self-service storage, the parking impact zone, ground-mounted solar panels, and illustrations. There will also be substantive changes and discussion on the parking of major recreational equipment and allowing contractor shops in the P1 corridor. Presuming the town council approves the amendments, the town would hold a public hearing at the Planning Commission's June 5th meeting. The amendment would return, with the Planning Commission's recommendation, to the Town Council for final approval as early as June 16th. The Council will also vote on the following: awarding a contract to George Gildner for the 2025 Sump Pump Discharge and Storm Sewer Improvements Project for $296,000. Authorizing the renewal of the town's Municipal Insurance Cooperative Agency Program for 2025-26. Vacating easement on lots 367-368 of the 11th addition to Vineyard Subdivision 3623 and 3625 Cabernet Court to create one large lot for a single-family residence. And finally, approving the re-subdivision of lots 367-368 of the 11th addition to Vineyard Subdivision to create one large lot for a single-family residence. The council meets at 7 p.m. tonight on the fourth floor of the Uptown Station. Council meetings are also live streamed on the town's YouTube channel. Before the meeting at 6:55 p.m., newly elected town council members will be sworn in. Also on the front page, Pritzker, AOC emerge as Democratic leaders from Atlanta. The billionaire heir and the former bartender. Many Democrats have been in and out of the spotlight as the party looks for effective counters to Trump and his second administration. But two desperate figures, Governor Pritzker of Illinois and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, have seen their national profiles rise by delivering messages that excite a demoralized and fractured party. The governor, a 60-year-old heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune, and the congresswoman, the 35-year-old with working-class roots, both won their first elections in 2018. Both have urged mass resistance and accused their party of not fighting more. Each has stood out enough to draw sharp retorts from Trump loyalists. But as messengers, Pritzker and Ocasio-Cortez could not be more different, and their arguments, despite some overlap, are distinct enough to raise familiar questions for Democrats. Should they make their challenges to Trump about threats to democracy and national stability, as Pritzker has done, or portray him as a corrupt billionaire exacerbating an uneven economy, as Ocasio-Cortez does? And beyond the message itself, what qualities should the best messenger have? What links them, said one prominent Democrat, is assertiveness. People want Trump and Trumpism to be met with equal passion and force, said National Urban League President Mark Morrell, a former New Orleans mayor deeply connected to the Democratic politics. On that front, he added, OAC and Pritzker are both effective national figures, but in very different ways. Pritzker was born at the bridge of the baby boomers and Generation X into a sprawling family, now entrenched in Democratic politics. Like Trump, he inherited great wealth, but he lambasted the president as a poser on working-class issues. He chaired Illinois' Human Rights Commission before running for governor. In office, he has signed an Illinois minimum wage increase and is an ally of unions. His family's hotels are unionized, making them regular options for official Democratic Party events. When Democratic President Biden exited the 2024 campaign, Pritzker was floated as a replacement. He made no visible moves, quickly backed Kamala Harris, and acted as the de facto host of her nominating convention in his home state. Take it from an actual billionaire. Trump is rich in only one thing, stupidity, Pritzker said in Chicago. Since Harris's defeat, Pritzker has behaved like a future candidate. One of the nation's highest-profile Jewish politicians, he fired up liberals by comparing the Trump administration to the Third Reich. If you think I'm overreacting and sounding the alarm too soon, consider this. It took the Nazis 1 month, 3 weeks, 2 days, 8 hours, and 40 minutes to dismantle a constitutional republic, the governor said in his joint budget and State of the State address on February 19th. All I'm saying is when the five-alarm fire starts to burn, Every good person better be ready to man a post with a bucket of water if you want to stop it from raging out of control. Addressing party faithful in the traditional early nominating state of New Hampshire, Pritzker bemoaned do-nothing Democrats, called for party honchos to set aside decades of stale decorum, and urged voters into the streets. Never before in my life have I called for mass protests, for mobilization, for disruption, but I am now, he said. Democrats must castigate Republicans on the soapbox and then punish them at the ballot box. It was enough for senior Trump aide Stephen Miller to accuse Pritzker of inciting violence. Pritzker wasted no time returning the volley, calling it terrible hypocrisy for Trump allies to complain, given the Capitol siege on January 6, 2021, and Trump's pardon of the rioters. Ocasio-Cortez is a millennial progressive who earned degrees in international relations and economics and worked as a waiter and bartender before entering politics. With support from the Progressive Working Families Party, she ousted a top House Democrat, Joe Rowley, in 2018 primary. Like Trump, she leverages millions of social media followers. Also like Trump, she is an economic populist. But she comes from the left wing of U.S. politics, and without the anti-immigration and cultural conservatism of Trump's right wing or the alliances with billionaire business and tech elites. She has recently headlined Fighting Oligarchy Tour with Bernie Sanders, a two-time presidential candidate. The tour has drawn tens of thousands of people across the country, notably including reliable Republican states, often with overflow crowds outside many stops. Ocasio-Cortez's next political move seems less certain than Pritzker's. She is seen as a potential primary challenger to Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader from New York, and she only recently became old enough to be constitutionally eligible for the presidency. But she appears poised to inherit the mantle of the 83-year-old Sanders movement. She freely criticizes Trump, but she leans more heavily into broader economic and social critiques that she's made since her first House bid and that Sanders has offered for decades. For years, we have known that our political system has slowly but surely become dominated by big money and billionaires, and time after time, we have seen how our government and laws are more responsive to corporations and lobbyists than everyday people and voters. She advocated for living wages, stable housing, guaranteed health care, and blasted the agenda of dark money to keep our wages low and to loot our public goods like Social Security and Medicare. She also played up her roots from the waitress who is now speaking to you today. I can tell you, impossible is nothing. And from the local page, fallen officers honored for service from Springfield. 9 Illinois police officers who lost their lives at the line of duty in 2024 were honored at a ceremony in Springfield on Thursday. The Illinois Peace Officers Memorial takes place every year on the first Thursday of May to honor officers who died on the job in the prior year. Families of the officers are given a plaque honoring their family members' service by the state's constitutional elected officials, and the officers' names are inscribed on a memorial outside the Illinois Capitol. They woke up every single day knowing that they may be called on to face extreme uncertainty, that on a moment's notice they may be required to put themselves in harm's way to save another, Pritzker said. This year's event honored DeKalb County Deputy Sheriff Christina Musel, Department of Corrections Officer Andrew Fraught, Chicago Police Officer Louis Hawaska, Cook County Corrections Deputy Sheriff Raphael Woodlow, Chicago Police Officer James Crowley, and Oak Park Detective Alan Reddins. This year's event also honored canines for the first time, including canine officers that died in the line of duty from Rockford, Lake County, and Alton last year. The families that we induct today never asked to be a part of this somber club, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton said. Treasurer Mike Friedrichs also gave an emotional speech honoring his cousin, a California police officer who recently died. Friedrichs' office provides a college scholarship fund for children of first responders who died on the job. Former ISP Trooper Kim Cessna, who leads a nonprofit for family members of fallen police officers, gave a personal remembrance of her colleague Thompson, who was killed in a crash last October. We take these memories with us, allowing them to guide us, reminding us the beauty they brought into our lives. We carry their love in our hearts, and we let that love become a source of strength. Kathleen M.A., the sister of Bradley Police Officer Marlene Remnick, who died in 21, described the emotional toll that court cases take on families following an officer's death. 4 years of hell to get what you call justice is absolutely heart-wrenching and ridiculous. Remnick's killer was sentenced in January to life in prison. Martinez's death was on Comptroller Susana Mendoza's mind. Martinez was shot and killed during a traffic stop last November on Chicago's South Side by a man with an illegally modified gun. But it was the suspect's criminal history that Mendoza said bothered her the most. Block Club Chicago reported the man was on electronic monitoring when he killed Martinez and had multiple prior convictions, including battery, fleeing the police, and aggravated discharge of a firearm. He was also awaiting trial on drug charges at the time of the murder. Chicago police officer Enrique Martinez would be with us right now and not on this button or the memorial wall outside if the monster that murdered him was locked up instead of out committing crimes while out on electronic monitoring. Mendoza, a Chicago Democrat and sister of a Chicago police officer, blasted portions of the Safety Act, a 2021 police reform law championed by Democrats after George Floyd's murder in 2020. She said as an elected official, she needs to do more to speak out against policies she believes jeopardize officer safety. Mendoza called on lawmakers to remove a provision in state law that requires people on home confinement with or without electronic monitoring to be given 2 days of movement. When we give more rights to the criminals than we do to our police officers, we end up with dead officers and increased crime in our communities. Profiling fears swirl. Administration plans to require migrants to register and carry papers. The Trump administration's plan to strictly require anyone illegally in the U.S. to register with the government and carry documentation is stirring up fears of heightened racial profiling, even among legal residents, immigrants' rights advocates say. For some, it's a return to a climate from the recent past in which police departments and other law enforcement agencies' insistence on documentation drove immigrants underground and increased public safety concerns. A federal judge in recent weeks sided with Trump in a lawsuit brought by immigrants' rights groups over the policy, and the mandate took effect April 11th. Trump officials say they're enforcing federal law under which everyone 14 and older without legal status must self-register and give fingerprints and an address. Parents and guardians of anyone younger must ensure that they are registered. Not doing so is considered a crime, and a lack of documents risks prison time and fines. The mandate has rarely been enforced under previous administrations. To complicate matters, authorities recently detained even people born in the U.S. amid confusion over policies. An online appointment app used by temporary residents sent work permit cancellations since late March, including to U.S. citizens. A growing number of Republican-led states also refused to recognize state driver's licenses specially issued for immigrants without documents. "It's made a drastic change in the way we interact with our community," Martin Queza, a former Democratic state lawmaker and the attorney for the Council Relations of Arizona, said in a news conference. "I think it's racial profiling, certainly going to start spiking now, but I also think the extremity of everything that's happened is going to create some unity." Gerline Joseph, executive director of the nonprofit Haitian Bridge Alliance, said racial profiling already happens at a disproportionate rate to black migrants. The sudden pivot aggravated things, and people with temporary protected status or who had regular immigration and customs enforcement check-ins were detained during travel. She decried the ordeal as psychological warfare. Migrants allowed temporary legal residents are not sure if they need to protectively carry documents at all times. It is very hard to even communicate with the community members on what to do, telling them they need to know their rights, but they trample on their rights anyway. We are back in the show me your papers era. The new mandate evokes previous instances of certain groups having to carry documentation. During the time of enslavement in the U.S., freed black people had to have freedom papers or risk being re-enslaved. During World War II, Japanese Americans were required to register and keep identification cards, but were put in incarceration camps. The statutes that are on the books about registration have been dormant for 85 years, said Lynn Marcus, director of immigration law clinics at the University of Arizona. There weren't forms to comply with this requirement. It was created in wartime originally. The renewed strict registration requirement forces U.S. citizens to carry birth certificates or other proof of citizenship at all times, especially if they have a foreign appearance. People who are valid residents or visa holders potentially could be profiled based on factors other than physical characteristics. Let's say law enforcement encounters someone in another circumstance, maybe they're reporting a crime. They might not be satisfied with answers if they aren't able to communicate because not all U.S. citizens speak fluent English. Eileen McConnell, professor at Arizona State University, pointed to the effects of the 2010 Arizona law requiring all immigrants to obtain or carry immigration registration papers. In 2012, the Justice Department sued the state over the law, and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the papers requirement. But those 2 years when the requirement was in place were traumatic for Latino families in the state. Parents wouldn't ride together in a car. They were always separated because they were worried they would be stopped. People don't leave their house. She has done extensive research on how immigration policies can impact the mental health of mixed households of family members who are American-born and don't have documents. In previous years, children report, even if they were U.S.-born, real harm impacts on their own sleep, worry, not eating, and depression. Pharmaceutical makers' tariffs will impact up to $70 million from Chicago. Tariffs will likely cost Deerfield-based Baxter International $60 to $70 million this year, the company's chief financial officer said in an earnings call. Baxter expects to see most of the impact from increased tariffs in the second half of the year, said Joel Grade, executive vice president. Baxter makes IV fluids, a number of pharmaceuticals, and other hospital products. We are able to mitigate a portion of these impacts. Currently, a majority of Baxter's products sold in the U.S. are manufactured in the U.S. and made largely from U.S.-made components. However, international procurement is part of their business operations and as such are impacted from the U.S. and retaliatory tariffs that have been issued. Though only a small percentage of Baxter's total sales are in China, given the magnitude of the tariffs that have been enacted between the two countries, these tariffs now account for nearly half of the total impact. Trump has proposed sweeping tariffs on a number of countries in an effort to boost jobs and manufacturing in the U.S. last month. Trump suspended most of those tariffs, but not China, for 90 days. The Trump administration has not yet imposed tariffs on pharmaceuticals, but is now investigating how imports of pharmaceuticals and their ingredients affect national security. Baxter's assumptions do not include any potential changes to tariffs on pharmaceutical products. Baxter is considering a number of strategies to mitigate the impact of tariffs, including carrying additional inventory, identifying alternative suppliers, alternative shipping routes, and targeted pricing actions. Baxter is also working with its trade association partners to advocate for possible exemptions. Some of these actions will be able to realize more near-term to help mitigate the impact in 2025, and others will require more time to be implemented, but will help offset the impact in future years. Grade's comments about tariffs came during an otherwise positive quarterly results. Baxter, which saw its net income increase $126 million in the first quarter of this year, compared with an increase of $39 million in the first quarter last year. The quarterly results were Baxter's first since selling off its kidney care business to global investment firm Carlyle for $3 billion earlier this year. That business is now called Vateen, and its headquarters is in the former Caterpillar building in Deerfield. In recent weeks, a number of companies have been quantifying the impacts of the tariffs. The CEO of North Suburban-based Abbott Laboratories said during an earnings call last month that he expected tariffs to cost the company a few hundred million dollars in the second half of this fiscal year. And from Bloomington, City of Refuge plans mental health support. City of Refuge Ministries will host a mental health support conference from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, May 24th at the church, 404 Brock Drive in Bloomington. During the We Care Mental Health Support Conference, mental health professionals, advocates, and community leaders will be brought together to share resources, strategies, and support for individuals, families, and organizations navigating mental health challenges. This conference is an opportunity to build awareness, break the stigma, and provide actionable tools and resources. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required at comebloomington.com. For more information, look online. Meet Ronan the Dancing Sea Lion. Ronan the Sea Lion can still keep a beat after all these years. She can groove to rock and electronica, but the 15-year-old California Sea Lion's talent shines most in bobbing to disco hits like Boogie Wonderland. "She just nails that one," said Peter Cook, a behavioral neuroscientist at the New College of Florida. Not many animals show a clear ability to identify and move to a beat, aside from humans, parrots, and some primates. But then there's Ronan, a bright-eyed sea lion that has scientists rethinking the meaning of music. The former rescue sea lion, she burst to fame around a decade ago after scientists reported her musical skills. From age three, she has been a resident at the University of California. Ronan joined a select group of animal movers and shakers, which also includes Snowball, the famed dancing cockatoo, that together upended the long-held idea that the ability to respond to music and recognize a beat was distinctly human. The new study confirms Ronan's place as one of the top ambassadors of animal musicality. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, May 5th. Please stay tuned.